From WXXI News, this is Connections. I'm Evan Dawson. Our connection for this hour was made in the remote Chinese mountains, where the Chinese Academy of Sciences has been working for years to build a dish, a massive, state-of-the-art radio dish specially designed to pick up signals from alien civilizations. China is trying to make first contact with alien life, and their new dish is powering up, the most powerful the world has seen, the largest dish in our world. A new piece in The Atlantic magazine poses some fascinating questions. It's titled, What Happens If China Makes First Contact? Maybe your first reaction is, well, cool, somebody should, alien life. And no doubt it would be cool for like a second, but it could also be extremely dangerous. And you see, one of China's biggest stars is the novelist Liu Cixin. And President Barack Obama told the New York Times that he read Liu's trilogy called The Three-Body Problem and found it riveting, sweeping in its scope. The novels begin with the people of Earth making contact with an alien race. It does not go well. Liu believes in the dark forest concept of alien life. What does dark forest mean? We will explain that in a moment. This hour, it's a chance to discuss the risks and possible rewards of making first contact. And so, of course, we called on our dynamic duo in this regard. Brian Koberlein is Senior Lecturer of Physics at RIT and the author of the blog One Universe at a Time. Brian, welcome back to the program.
Thanks for having me again.
Roger Duby is Research Professor and Director of the Science Exploration Program at RIT. Roger, welcome back.
Thank you, Evan.
You guys had a chance to take a look at what The Atlantic had to say about this, and I really recommend the piece by Ross Anderson. Very interesting stuff here. I'm just going to start with the broad outline here. Should we be sending any signals out there as a big neon sign that says, we are here, Brian?
I'm going to say it's worth a shot.
I'm going to
disagree with the dark forest idea.
Okay. I'm a big fan of the dark forest idea, so I can't wait to disagree with Brian. And I get to be like Dunning-Kruger guy who knows nothing about this stuff, disagreeing with an actual scientist. But anyway, you say yes. You say advertising our position to the universe is not a bad thing.
Right. I don't think it's harmful. I think, you know, central to the idea of the dark forest is that other civilizations have an intent to destroy civilizations that are not them. And usually those are driven on resources. And the amount of resources that we have in the universe is vast. There's no reason for an alien civilization to want to take over our planet or steal our water or anything like that.
There's no reason?
No. In fact, if you think of like stealing water from Earth, there is more water on Europa or Ganymede, moons of Jupiter, than there are on Earth.
Really?
Water is very common. water is profoundly common.
Oh, yeah? Well, what did we just find out about Mars?
Well, but Mars is a dry planet, but not everything is.
No,
the outer solar system is rich
Dunning-Kruger
with water.
So, but the bottom line is what you're saying is water is much more abundant than we probably realize?
Yeah, it's extremely abundant. It's not as abundant in the inner solar system, but it's certainly abundant in the outer solar system.
Okay. So there's an argument in favor of advertising our position. Roger, advertise our position.
Okay, so let me back up for a moment and point out that it's too late. In particular, when radio was first developed, those signals started propagating out into space right away. Radio, television, they've been propagating for over 100 years now, and we can't pull them back. They are floating out into the universe, and there's nothing we can do about it.
Well, at what strength, though? Because one of the things I'm curious about is what China has built. Their dish is enormous. Doesn't it change the possibility?
So China's dish is about 2.5 times more sensitive than Arecibo, for example. And so it will be able to hear things, quote, hear. It will be able to pick up signals that are much weaker than what Arecibo has been able to do. What historically radio telescopes have been doing is looking for the very same signature that we've been emitting into space since radio was first invented. So everything about that approach looks at radio wavelengths. And I would argue that there are actually, at least in our civilization now, techniques that are competitively more powerful in terms of detecting possibilities for life on other planets than just looking at the radio spectrum.
What you're such a homer, because that's what you're doing over at RIT.
What the radio telescope approach assumes is that there are other civilizations that have developed radio that are continuing to communicate using those wavelengths, and that we will pick up these broadcasts, and that is certainly a possibility. But I would argue that with properly configured multispectral imaging techniques on Kepler, space-based telescopes, we should be able to find signatures of organic molecules and perhaps even organisms at a much faster pace than we're able to do, looking for that narrow window of time when civilizations have progressed to a point where they're broadcasting things at radio wavelengths. There's a tacit assumption there that that is somehow a figure of merit that's important.
But there was, decades ago, there was a cadre of scientists, not the least of which included people like Carl Sagan, who sent out into the universe essentially a capsule, mm-hmm. a capsule of us,
yes.
hoping that eventually it's going to land in the lap of some alien civilization. And that's another way to advertise your position. And looking back now, decades ago, was that a mistake, Roger?
I would argue no. Number one, that particular capsule, if you want to call it that, that time capsule, just left the boundary of our solar system. It's just moved out into the interplanetary region, so it's no longer within the effect of our sun. It's got a long way to go. It's got some 50 years, couple of hundred years maybe, before it even begins to approach anything out there. So I don't think it's a concern. By the way, it's only going to approach something out there in the specific direction that was chosen. It's not as if it's broadcasting anything.
Yeah.
It's just traveling in one direction to one place. If there's nothing there, it was a waste.
I think what this comes down to is you're the kind of guy who just doesn't lock your doors at night, isn't it?
That's right. I have two dogs.
Brian, do you lock your doors?
Yeah, but, you know, the idea that you can hide from an intelligent alien civilization is probably incorrect. As Roger has said, even if we didn't transmit radio signals, which we already have, there are ways to detect the presence of life on other planets that we're working on, studying their atmospheres and things like that. Other alien civilizations, if they are sufficiently advanced, would be able to recognize that we are a planet that has life. They would know this, and if they were that paranoid, they could come after us.
I'm going to kind of talk a little bit about this fascinating set of novels called The Three-Body Problem. A Chinese author, and won all kinds of awards. It's become super nuclear hot in China, inspired their own versions of the... They kind of joke that it's the Chinese Star Wars that they've been working on based on his novels. And the Atlantic Monthly's piece, What Happens If China Makes First Contact, interviews Liu Cixin, and Liu has a lot to say about this issue because he has a lot to say to the Atlantic, but he also has a lot to say in his novels, which are fiction. But he does talk about the dark forest idea. And I'm going to quote from the Atlantic Monthly in terms of how he views the appearance of the other. Quote, in some ways it's no surprise that China invited Liu to see their dish. He has an outside voice on cosmic affairs in China, and the government's aerospace agency sometimes asks him to consult on science missions. He's the patriarch of the country's science fiction scene. But in other ways, he's a strange choice to visit this dish. He has written a great deal about the risks of first contact. He has warned that the appearance of this other might be imminent and that it might result in our extinction. Perhaps in 10,000 years, the starry sky that humankind gazes upon will remain empty and silent, he writes in the postscript to one of his books. But perhaps tomorrow, we'll wake up and find an alien spaceship the size of the moon parked in orbit. End quote. And so he goes on to talk about the dark forest theory, the idea that civilization is like that the universe is like a dark forest, and that we are like hunters and prey in the universe, and that there are plenty of others out there. We are just one of them, but they are doing what smart animals do in the forest, which is hide, because you stick your head up and you get annihilated. This is apparently just not a concern to you. You said it's just probably not realistic. This is too science fiction to you, Brian.
For me, yeah. I mean, if you take the hunter-prey idea, hunters and prey have a common ancestor. So on Earth, all living things have a common ancestor. So we have hunters and prey because hunters can kill and eat prey as a resource. If you have an alien species that evolves independently on another planet, it's very possible that they don't even share common DNA, much less any compatibility for food or resources or anything. The thing that we do share in common are the elements in the universe.
So they might not need our resources.
No, if they need iron, if they need carbon, nitrogen, oxygen, water, those are very common everywhere in the universe.
So there's that brings up one of two ideas. Would they need our resources, and would they try to appropriate them violently? Or would they fear that if they leave us alone, we will advance to the point where we will destroy them? And they will. So that is one of the themes that comes up in this trilogy of books. This idea that this alien race knows that Earth exists, knows that Earth is not on its level of technology, but knows that that technology level will gain over time. And one of the concerns is you better wipe them out now before they can rise to threaten you. That's not a concern to you either?
No, we don't do that with chimpanzees. We don't. While chimpanzees face extinction, they face extinction because of resources that humans in that area are desperate for.
Humans are terrible to animals. What are you talking
about?
Well,
they can be, but the idea that as something that would find a technological threat to us, the closest thing is maybe dolphins or chimpanzees. We don't see them as an existential threat because as they start using tools, perhaps, we'll have better tools. We're not worried about that because we're so far ahead of them technologically that we'll continue to be that far ahead of them technologically.
Okay. I mean, if dolphins were working on creating firearms, I would probably at least convene a summit with the dolphins.
Well, yeah, you can convene a summit, but you don't think, we need to eliminate all dolphins.
They're very unpredictable. Roger?
Yeah, so I just see all sorts of topics bubbling up here, and it's hard to keep track of all of them.
So let's hit them one at a time.
So let's see if I can just hit a couple of them. So point number one, as Brian points out, we share the Earth with other predators that are at the top of the food chain, and the whole signature of being at the top of the food chain is that you need to consume other organisms in order to eat, in order to survive. And those might be plants, they might be animals. The same is true for dolphins. They happen to be in a totally different biosphere. We don't compete with them for food. But there's another, perhaps more subtle point that needs to be raised that throws another factor of two into this whole equation. And that is biologically active molecules have a quality called chirality. Chirality is a feature that gives a molecule a handedness. So if you think of a right-handed screw or a left-handed screw, there's sort of a spiral structure to it. That is called chirality. And it turns out that molecules that have chirality are biologically active. They can actually form more advanced molecules that ultimately will produce proteins, amino acids, et cetera, and you end up with living organisms being produced by these fundamental chiral molecules. The curious thing about Earth is that the Earth is dominated. I mean, more than 90% of the biologically active molecules on Earth are left-handed chiral. They have a directionality that's best described with the left hand. There's no a priori reason to believe that Earth would have left or right-handed chiral molecules. We really should see both of them in equal proportions, but we don't. Earth is dominated by left-handed chiral molecules. If we encounter organisms that have right-handed chiral molecules, we can't digest them. They're useless to us because the molecules don't match, and so when we try to consume them and use their protein for our
livelihood. Is there an example of that?
I can't give you a quick example because I can't think of something that has the right-handed molecular signature to it.
Because it's so rare here?
It's very rare.
Okay.
Yeah. And it's a bit of a mystery with astrobiology. In particular, why is it that Earth is dominated by left-handed chiral molecules? We don't know. We just know that it's there. So we've done experiments in the lab to recreate early conditions of Earth. And what we find in the lab are equal contributions of left and right-handed chiral molecules. But on Earth, for some reason, the left-handed ones dominate. And the right-handed ones are hard to find, and they're just totally excluded from our food chain. They're useless. Right.
But how does that relate from the fact that dolphins should not be wielding a firearm?
Okay. All I'm saying is that, so we've got a different biosphere for dolphins, and there's this other hidden biosphere, which is molecular chirality, that cuts things in half yet again. Mm-hmm. So, you know, an alien civilization looking at us and saying, oh, gee, there's a great food source. We should go take over the planet.
Maybe not.
We may be totally useless to them, completely useless. So then the question becomes, why? What is the motivating factor for them to try to annihilate us? The concept that we are just automatically going to try to annihilate them?
Fear.
It just seems so...
Reality TV. Whatever they could pick up from us that makes us a deserving target.
Yeah, I have a lot of trouble connecting with that. I just
don't. Pop radio. Whatever it is. But
I don't believe that humans are, that advanced, any advanced species is naturally antagonistic toward others. I just don't see why it would be like that.
That's a very optimistic viewpoint, and I'm really actually happy to hear that both of you share that. You want to add to that, Brian? You were jumping there.
Yeah, I think, you know, one of the things you have to keep in mind is that in order to be in an advanced alien civilization, you have to go through the development and continuation of a civilized society over a long period of time. You don't just pop up instantaneously. We've been a civilized society for at least thousands of years, and any species that were so xenophobic that just the presence of an alien would cause them to go into an extinction mode would probably be xenophobic with themselves. They would probably wipe themselves out long before they could develop space technology or anything else.
This is where Ross Anderson makes a point that echoes what Brian is saying that I thought was really strong, which is that when other forms of life, and I think everybody at this table agrees that there's probably other technological civilizations out. I mean, probably, right? Just the odds say.
Odds are pretty high, I would think.
Mm-hmm. We haven't seen them, but
that's
probably
correct. That's a different problem.
To get to that point, to get to any point of technological civilization, at least we know the law of thermodynamics travels, right? So, you know, they're going to have feedback loops when it comes to energy consumption. They may have climate change issues. They may have societal strife. They may experience warfare. And what Ross Anderson is arguing in his piece, or at least raising the question in his piece for the Atlantic Monthly, What Happens If China Makes First Contact, is that any technological alien civilization that is so powerful that it can traverse the stars has figured out how to live peacefully within itself, first of all. And so it knows the value of peace as opposed to constant domination and warfare. Does that line up with the point that you're making?
Yeah, I think
there,
Brian? That's a fair point.
Couldn't you also argue that any alien civilization that gets to that point has survived because it learns how to dominate, that it is strong, that it is a survivor, and it will protect itself?
Yes.
Well, those things are in conflict.
No, I don't think they are.
Okay.
So if you are an adult and you're strong and you can protect yourself, an angry child coming towards you is not something that you want to destroy. They can't hurt you. They're much weaker than you are. So you can have compassion for them. You can try to isolate or protect them. But the idea that we need to eliminate some society that's vastly weaker than us, even today, even in the horrible human species that we are, is a rare idea. We recognize the problem of that or the immorality of that in ourselves. So an alien species, we as this, you know, horrible human species, if we found other aliens, we wouldn't think to just completely destroy them.
I would hope not.
you know, would we have conflicts? We certainly could have conflicts, but conflicts are not the same as trying to have outright extinction.
Okay, Roger?
Yeah, and I echo that completely. The conflicts that have arisen amongst humans are a competition for resources in some way or other. That's not something that would be a component, I think, in contact with civilizations that live elsewhere. We are way too remote. The resources that we need to survive are plentiful throughout the universe or galaxy, and the same is true for them. And so I don't see the fundamental driving force of competition that people are afraid of here. I just don't see what causes that to happen. I can see an opportunity for beneficial sharing of information to the benefit of both civilizations, but I don't see how that will give rise to competition. We're just too far apart. We're too sparse. I just don't see how that can happen.
Okay, I'm going to get to your phone calls in a second, and with Josh in Rochester, we'll come to you in just a second. Listeners, if you want to weigh in on this, it's 844-295-TALK. That's toll-free, 844-295-8255, or 263-WXXI if you're in Rochester, 263-9994. It's connections at WXXI.org. If you want to email the program, you can find me on Twitter at Evan Dawson. Our guests from RIT, Brian Koberlein, Senior Lecturer of Physics and the author of the blog One Universe at a Time, Roger Duby, a research professor and director of the Science Exploration Program there, and this is Josh in Rochester First. Go ahead, Josh.
Yeah, hi. So I'm loving this conversation. I'm just really curious what you think of sort of our fear that they, you know, inevitably will attack us. And you know, when we come in contact, my concern is that there will be sort of this self-fulfilling prophecy where we're concerned about them attacking us. So we have to research, find out how we can, you know, possibly, you know, kill them if we have to, and sort of that, and then putting them on the defense. So inevitably it does become, you know, I'm sort of curious, like, what do you think about, like, if we are the aggressors? We're concerned about mm-hmm. them being the aggressors,
yep.
but we're the ones going out on the hunt.
Yeah. Josh, stay there because I want to – wow, our phones are filled all of a sudden. And everyone is either calling in to agree with me or to talk about their fear of murderous dolphins. But I want to stay with Josh for a second because he's raising an interesting point. I think I have a question for Josh, if I'm going to interpret this correctly, but I'm going to take Josh's point like this. Let's say we get visited, or at least some kind of contact happens, and we are not able to achieve what they are achieving technologically, but we are ready for war should they show up here. I think, obviously, guys, that's a mistake, because anybody who's strong enough to come here, this isn't Hollywood. We're not going to magically figure out a warp drive and to take down their ships when they show up on our midst, and being aggressive would only put us in more danger, I would think. So I actually don't think that would happen. Pragmatically, I think the governments of the world would probably agree on that, that we would hope for a very diplomatic approach. Roger?
I certainly would hope so. I think it would be a tragic mistake to assume that the other species is aggressive and that we need to make the first move before they wipe us out. I think that would be a very pessimistic and unfortunate position to take. I think although we would be facing lots of challenges in terms of learning how to communicate with one another, share experiences, share technologies, et cetera, that's a very big hill to climb. It would be a shame to destroy that opportunity by being a first aggressor based on sort of a Hollywood vision of what we think aliens are going to do when they get here.
Yeah, fair. Brian?
I agree. I mean, I think we have to understand that if we were to have an alien species that were to visit us, either in person or by some robotic mission, you have to understand how much it would actually take to get here. You know, it would take a tremendous amount of power. So the creation of power would have to be plentiful and easy in their society. It would have to be the recycling of materials. You can only take a certain amount of materials on a spacecraft. You would have to be incredibly efficient. So conservation and recycling has to be incredibly powerful. in this technology. Any civilization that can travel across the stars will have to have ready and ample power, ready access to resources, and know how to recycle them well. Then you compound that with the idea that if they have made it that far, they have probably dealt with all the issues of strife and conflict within their own civilization and recognized the downsides of that. And then they get here. What possible reason do they have to destroy us? They wouldn't come here if they didn't know that we were here. They wouldn't come here unless they knew there was something here, because they don't need it for resources. There's nothing about our solar system that matters.
I regret saying you're starting to convince me. and I want to be sanguine about this, because I want to see the beauty in achieving the information, the enlightenment that comes with understanding how other civilizations are operating. And of course, I want that. I just want what is wise and safe. But this is why smarter people than I am are here. Brian and Roger. And so let's go ahead and let's get that break. We're going to come back to your phone calls here, because our phones are jammed up with people who want to weigh in. And a question from a listener as well. Katie wants to know, how do we think contact would be handled if the situation arose? And we're going to hit that from the perspective of what happens in Lou's book, in which the contact happens, but once the alien civilization is coming our way, we know we have 450 years before they get here. That's what happens in the book, which may be roughly the case in terms of, remember, you don't get to go there tomorrow. This is not like going to Brighton. You know, we got to figure out how to get there. And so you have some time to plan for it. Doesn't mean that the contact is a good one in the book. It leads to lots of danger. But we'll ask them how they think the interaction may go from afar and what it might mean if we even get a signal. There's this new dish in Southwest China in the mountains, and we're trying to at least detect radio signals. So let's go ahead and get that break. We'll come right back to your phone calls next on Connections. I'm Evan Dawson. Thursday on the next Connections. In our first hour, we're talking about the year in climate and climate action. Has it been a lost year for climate action, or are there lessons and progress to take into 2018? What are the top priorities for activists? Then in our second hour, Star Wars is back. If you don't love Star Wars, well, maybe the fans will make you change your mind. That's Thursday. Welcome back to Connections. I'm Evan Dawson. I recommend Ross Anderson's piece in the December issue of the Atlantic Monthly, What Happens If China Makes First Contact. Interesting stuff. They've got the world's largest dish powered up in the Chinese mountains now, and they are looking for radio signals from alien civilizations. And so our guests are talking about what happens in that eventuality, and they're trying to talk me off the ledge. And they're doing a pretty good job, I have to say. I'm coming around throughout this hour. We'll see if I get there by the end of it. This is Rosemary in Brighton next on the phone. Go ahead,
Hi.
Rosemary.
I don't think that the problem is with China per se, but there is a kind of problem with human beings who think they know how they're going to behave and have certain real weaknesses. And I'll tell you really quickly, I had a problem years ago with my son. I was trying to get him to behave in school. I put him in front of back then it was VCR tape, and he came back. I had been taking care of the baby. He came back to me really angry, and he said, "Mom, why can we blow up the world 25 times? There's only one world." And it was a terrible moment, because I'd been telling him he needed to behave, he needed to follow directions, and I knew whatever I said, it better not sound stupid. And I said, well, you know how we look at Greek myths and Achilles had this Achilles heel? Human beings confuse destruction with power. And it was a funny thing. I don't know that my son remembers it, but I never forgot it. It's like you say something and you suddenly realize, very, very often, the thing that ruins us, and it really, really kills people, is that we think it's somehow powerful when we're destroying something, when we show we can win. So I don't see it as so much a problem of China as I see it with a problem of human beings. You know, there is a Chinese culture and everything else, but the basic idea of confusing destruction with power is really much with us right now. Hmm.
Rosemary, thank you for the phone call. Okay, Brian, What do you think?
Well, I think that touches on the idea of alien civilizations to begin with, and it's a question we can ask of the human species. Mm-hmm. How long are we likely to last? And, you know, we've lasted for quite some time, but on cosmic scales, it's a very just short blink of an eye. And a star-faring species has to be able to survive longer and over a larger period of time. That's a question we don't have an answer to. You know, for myself, I think there's lots of evidence to support the idea that despite all of our problems, we tend to come together more than we divide. And over time, we tend to be more cooperative because of the advantages that gives us as a species. It's not perfect, and it won't be perfect, but I think any civilization that has a chance of surviving to reach the stars has to be far more cooperative than oppositional.
Yeah, and this is maybe we're entering a real era of tests for humankind climatologically, war, because of the weaponry we have and the destruction it can do. So, again, I do appreciate Brian's optimism. I mean, it sounds like Rosemary is a little less optimistic. And Joel writes to the program, Roger, and had this to say. Joel said, the entire history of humans tells another story. Why would we think our motives would be peaceful? Mm-hmm. So there are those who are a little less optimistic in our own intentions, let alone any other alien civilizations.
Sure.
But Joel also said this, Roger, couldn't another civilization have depleted its resources and set out to find the materials it needs?
Yes, that's certainly possible. But as we pointed out earlier, in order to get here, they would have to consume the very materials that they have presumably depleted back on their home. And so why would they continue pushing on if they ran into some other sequence of planetary bodies that would provide precisely the components that they need to refresh their civilization? Why would they push on to find a planet that happens to be inhabited by another advanced civilization? It's just there's a logical disconnect there. If you're hungry and you're walking through a field and you come across, you see an apple orchard in the distance, but you run into a tree that has amazing fruit on it, let's say mangoes or something, and you take a bite of the mango and you realize, oh my God, this is exactly what I need. Why would you keep pushing on? It's not solving the very problem that caused you to go out looking for food in the first place. So I don't think there would be a natural need to continue on and to carry through with the destruction or at least conquering of some other civilization. For me at least, there's a disconnect there. I don't see that as solving a problem.
Back to the phones we go. This is Fireside in Rochester. Go ahead.
Yes, Evan. Love your show. Gotta say that.
Thanks.
I got a question for your panel here. We've talked about a little bit about resources, such.
Oh no, we lost him. All right, listen. I am going to ask him. Now that he waited in line to call back, we lost the call. I'm going to go ahead and drop that. Let's see if I can bring it back. Are you there? No, I've lost Fireside. Let's go ahead. I'm going to call back, and we'll bring you back there. It's a new phone system. It's a host error. I'm getting used to it. It's new technology. If I can't master this phone system, we are not going to the stars. We are going to be overrun with dolphins hosting this show before we are going to the stars if I can't figure out the phone technology. Please call us back at 844-295-TALK. 844-295-8255. Tomorrow we're talking Star Wars. That's the fictional stuff. This is the actual real stuff this hour. And he's back on two. So let's go ahead and try it again. Sorry about that. Go ahead, sir.
Yes. This is Fireside again.
Yep.
So what I was saying is, you know, there's resources that we found quite common in the universe, in perhaps even in our own solar system. But one resource that we haven't found that we've, you know, all been searching for is life. And we have an abundance of life here on this planet. Now, if I'm an advanced civilization, and I'm looking throughout the solar system, throughout the stars, throughout the universe, the one thing that I could not find anywhere else might be, you know, an advanced civilization, even something with ourselves, you know, something to connect with, to learn from, to learn about our culture, our, you know, our whole way of life. That, I think, would be something that they couldn't come here to destroy. They wouldn't want to, you know, take over our planet for the habitat of it. And, yeah, I just think it's interesting that, you know, an advanced civilization, they would want to come and study our life and just see what we're all about.
Thank you for that. Roger, you want to start? Go ahead.
Sure. So this is thank you for all of those comments. These are great because they give us segues into a couple of other topics that we haven't touched on yet. One of them, which you actually tangentially touched, is what's called the Fermi paradox. And basically, there are so many stars out there. Why have we not encountered any other civilizations? And so you're basically saying that, and you were moving down the path to say, and so if they encounter us, they'll say, gee, here's this other advanced civilization with all these cultures and all these things. And I would take that opportunity to say, wow, think how much we can learn from them. And yet there's a tendency to also think in a different way, and that is, wow, look at this great civilization with all this culture and history. Let's destroy them. And I'm having trouble making that step. It's sort of not the way I think. It's more one of like understanding the awe and magic and power of living in this universe and experiencing what life can possibly give us. And it would be an amazing opportunity to share a completely different type of experience, of life experience, with some other civilization that is as advanced or more advanced than we are. So I don't see why we would want to destroy them. I'm missing that step. They can certainly find lots of other habitable planets. Kepler has given us a lot of data recently. In fact, there's going to be a NASA announcement
very soon.
Tomorrow,
the AI search of the Kepler data to have more exoplanets.
So we're finding that most stars have exoplanets. In fact, the vast majority do. And within any given stellar planetary system, there is very likely a planet that is in the habitable zone, the so-called Goldilocks zone. And so then the question becomes, well, okay, here's a perfect opportunity for life to appear. How far did it get? How advanced is it? Has it been existent for a long enough time? Did it have all of the right components to give us the richness that we experienced here on Earth, with the moon giving us tides that accelerated the appearance of life here on Earth? All of these factors are things that suggest that there should be lots of other biological systems in existence around other planets. We haven't found them yet. We can't travel that far, and we've only been looking at radio wavelengths, which is not the right wavelength to look at because we're just looking for a very particular subset of civilizations that happen to be using radio. We've only been there 200 years. That's like nothing in the span of lifetime of life here on Earth. It's just a microscopic fraction of how long life has existed here. So I believe that we're looking at the wrong signature, that we should really be focused on the more multispectral Kepler AI type of analyses to try to identify those places rather than looking at the radio telescope. One thing that I want to mention before I forget, I find the title of this article really odd. It basically says, what if China
makes
first contact. And to me, it's like, so what? These are people making alien contact. Granted, it would be a feather in their proverbial cap to make first contact. The Chinese are desperate for technological firsts like that, and so they would be thrilled. This would be something that would vault them right up to the top of the scientific world in terms of like, wow, look what you've just accomplished. But very quickly, that's something that's going to be shared with all people. And so then the question becomes, we've got to learn language, we've got to learn culture, we've got to learn history, we've got to share with them. How do we communicate with them? Hearing something, hearing a signal at the radio frequency does not give us contact. It just means that, oh, we heard something. What the heck was that? That's not contact.
And it would become all governments of the world would have to work together to decide how we're going to communicate. How do we get them hats that say, make the universe great again, whatever it is. Let me grab a phone call from Adam, and then we're going to go back to some of your emails. So go ahead, Adam.
Yes, how you doing?
Good.
Well, what I wanted to say was I believe that people's perception that someone is going to attack is probably something coming from their inner self. Because I give you a prime example. It's like I was in a relationship and the person kept thinking I was cheating on her or whatever the case may be. But come to find out, it was her that was cheating. So if you're the type of person that doesn't trust people, then you're going to believe that other people don't trust people. So maybe that's where this culture is coming from. And the fact that someone's saying, oh, well, you know, the Chinese or the Japanese or whatever are going to have contact with the aliens, maybe they're getting this this perception that they're going to find this technology and attack us because maybe we hit Hiroshima. You understand what I'm saying?
Yeah, I think we're projecting. That's a really interesting. Adam, thank you for the phone call. It's a really interesting point. It's when you're so worried about what somebody else is doing, what you're really just doing is projecting what you're doing onto others. But yeah, I think that's a fair point. Why do we have to decide that aliens are going to attack us? And are we going to convince ourselves that we need to attack them?
I would add a point to it, because part of the relation to this article is a science fiction novel out of China, which is very interesting, because there is this rise of science fiction from cultures not American European. And their perspective is very different. You know, if you're a science fiction author in the United States, you live in a society that is the dominant power on this planet. So the apex predator of countries, as it were. If you are from China, or if you are from Brazil, or if you are from Kenya, your perspective of the world and the idea of a more powerful civilization coming to Earth is very different, because you're seeing it from a very different side. And I think it's worth noting that the science fiction stories coming out of these regions of up-and-coming authors are worth listening to, because they're not only original, but they give us a different human perspective to this idea.
The Three-Body Trilogy, the Three-Body Problem is the name of the trilogy that we're talking about. If you want to check out the books, and President Obama told the New York Times it was a trilogy that he greatly enjoyed reading and kind of broadened his scope of thinking. Mark writes to the program and says, Evan, do you feel threatened by an anthill on a remote Pacific island? Would it make sense to wipe out their island with a ballistic missile or send a division of Marines to kick it over? We are even less of a threat to a hypothetical advanced alien race many light years away than the ants are to us now. Imagining that we are a threat to anyone else in the universe other than ourselves is pure fiction. That's from Mark. I think that analogy is pretty good with one exception. Those ants on an anthill, I know what their ceiling is. Their ceiling, in terms of danger, is biting whoever may step on them. Now, human beings are a different thing. When you are technological, so all I'm saying is that an alien race may look at us and say, right now we're the ants on the anthill, but could we ever develop in a direction that might make us threatening? I think the larger point is a pretty fair one, though. And I think I'm coming around to where Mark is and where Brian and Roger are. And I didn't want to admit it. But I think for the most part, anybody who is strong enough to find us and get here probably isn't instantly going to say, wipe us out. And I kind of want to see what that's going to happen. So Katie wanted to know, how would contact be handled? There's two different kinds of contact. There's that contact that seems up close, that looks like the movies when our spaceships are talking to their spaceships. But really, when The Atlantic writes about China trying to establish first contact with their new dish, they're talking about just finding the first signals of life, right, and then figuring out how we might establish contact going in the other direction. So Roger, Brian, I'll start with you, Roger.
Mm-hmm.
If there's any contact at all that says we know this is technological,
yes,
but it's not, you know, we can't decipher it yet, That's going to be a process. If we think we can communicate at all, what kind of contact should we be making back in its direction? Because you're the kind of guy who says, you don't believe in dark force. You want to make the contact.
Right.
So we find, I know you're not a big fan of the radio waves, but let's do the radio thing.
Well, we have no choice right now.
Yeah, that's it. That's what we're working with.
Yes.
What are you sending back, or what are you going to do next if we get that first
contact? I think, actually, that the attempt that Sagan and company did when they sent Voyager out was actually a really good way to approach it. It basically says, this is who we are. We have this DNA structure. Here's our mathematical system. This is the planet that we live on. It's distance from the sun. Here's where we're located relative to pulsars that are positioned throughout the galaxy so that they can actually pinpoint us, much like a GPS can, so that this civilization receiving this can say, oh, okay, we know exactly where we have to direct this signal, so now we can begin to hope to have a two-way conversation. Now, a two-way conversation by radio telescope is a very slow conversation. Today, Brian, correct me if I'm wrong, it takes 18 minutes for a signal to travel to Mars, or is it?
It's about 18 to 25 minutes, yeah. I think, depending on where it is.
So in that very simple case where you send a signal out to Mars and say, hi, my name is Roger, what's your name? You now wait 25 minutes for somebody to say, oh, hi, Roger, I'm Charlie. Now amplify that or increase the distance to 250 light years. That's a long conversation. Your signal has to travel 250 years out. They have to formulate a response, which will take no time compared to the 250 years. And then 250 years after that, you get an answer. That's 500 years that have gone by. This is not a casual conversation that we're having here in the studio. This is something that is very slow and very
measured.
Could that
speed up at all? Could that change at all?
Only by physical proximity. We, at least today, we don't have the technology to communicate faster than light. We don't have that technology. So everything is going to be limited by the speed of light. So we're talking about planetary systems that are 25, 50 light years away. So we're talking 50, 100 or more years for a simple exchange of thoughts.
Is it possible to travel faster than the speed of light?
Again, our mathematics doesn't suggest that we can do that. Maybe our mathematics is short. Maybe we haven't found that. But to date, we've not found a solution that gives us a path to do that.
So 4 light years away, which is what some of these exoplanets with Goldilocks zone planets, stars with Goldilocks zone planets, I think 4?
Mm-hmm. Four is the closest. That's the closest.
Four is the closest.
Sun.
Yep. Would take us how long to get to again?
If you mean physically?
Yeah, if we're going to go there.
10,000 years, something like that.
Don't, you're such a downer. We need to go faster.
Yeah.
Yeah.
No argument.
Okay.
The problem is if you go faster, then you can't stop once you get there because you've got to decelerate also.
Right.
And so you go screaming past this place at let's say, a tenth the speed of light, and you can't do a thing about it because you've spent all your time trying to get there.
David writes to the program and says, I find it humorous that we don't think that there's potential that aliens have been here before. Not saying they have, but there clearly is the potential. And if they have, they've left us alone. There's a lot of ancient evidence that there was a potential of a visit. Just a thought from David. It's possible because, to Roger and Brian's point, we have not been technological for very long at all in the length of civilization timescales in a universe sitting. I mean, it's been a blip of time in the universe. So if there was any other visits, yes, it might have been when we were puzzling out fire and the wheel and hunting and gathering, or even more primitive than that. So I don't know. I'm with you there, David. You got to catch a civilization right at the right time. And the time scales, that's the one downer I've had for this hour. But let's end on a high note. 1 minute left here, so 30 seconds apiece. The great benefit to first contact would be what, Brian?
Knowledge is power. If we know that there's another alien civilization out there, we have something to look for. We have something to learn from. And they have something to learn from us.
So power is not power. Knowledge is power.
Knowledge is power.
Knowledge is what we're pursuing.
Yeah.
And that's how we can achieve it.
the more we know, the better chance we can continue to survive.
All right, Roger, the great benefit of first contact would be what?
Sharing experiences. So very much like being in love with a person, imagine sharing all of your experiences with someone else that you can't see. They have entirely different experiences, and they can share what they've done, and you can share what they've done, what you've done. It's an opportunity for amazing discoveries.
Well, the truth is out there. That's what our production team is telling me anyway. I believe you. And you know what? Maybe someday. Maybe Fermi, when he looked up and wondered, where is everybody? Maybe it is a dark forest thing and they're all hiding. Or maybe it's just far away and technology is slowly improving. Interesting stuff. The piece is What Happens If China Makes First Contact. It's in the December issue of the Atlantic Monthly Magazine. Brian Koberlein and Roger Duby from RIT. Great stuff as always. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Are you going to go see Star Wars on Friday? You guys Star Wars
Saturday,
guys?
Yeah, but yes.
Can't make it Friday.
I have an exam on Friday.
We are talking Star Wars tomorrow at 1, but that is a cautionary tale. Maybe we shouldn't be poking our head up. I've seen Star Wars. A special thanks to intern Audrey Sample. It's her last day. She's done wonderful work for us for the last few months. So, Audrey, thank you to you. Come back often. We've loved having you every day here. Rob Braden, the engineer. Megan Mack, producer. I'm Evan Dawson. Be safe out there. We'll talk to you tomorrow.